Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Confrontation Clause Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On February 28, 2011, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Michigan v. Bryant. This case concerns statements made by a gunshot victim to responding police officers. In those statements, the victim identified the defendant as the shooter. Shortly thereafter, the victim died, but his statements to the police were nevertheless introduced at the defendant's trial, and the defendant was convicted of second-degree murder. The question before the Supreme Court was whether the admission of the deceased victim's statements violated the defendant's rights under the Sixth Amendment's Confrontation Clause. By a vote of 5-3, the court held that the admission of the victim's statements did not violate the requirements of the Confrontation Clause. The primary purpose of the statements, the majority stated, was to help the police meet an ongoing emergency. As a result, the statements were not testimonial and did not violate the defendant's rights under the Confrontation Clause. Justice Sotomayor delivered the opinion of the court, in which Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Kennedy, Breyer, and Alito joined. Justice Thomas filed an opinion concurring in the judgment. Justices Scalia and Ginsburg each filed a dissenting opinion. Justice Kagan took no part in the consideration or decision of the case. To discuss the case, we have Michael B. Brennan, who is a partner at Gass Weber Mullins, LLC. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Brennan.
Hello, this is Mike Brennan with a post-decision podcast on the United States Supreme Court's decision in Michigan versus Bryant. This case represents the next step in the Supreme Court's growing Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause jurisprudence, begun by the court in its decisions in Crawford versus Washington in 2004 and continued in Davis versus Washington in 2006, as well as other cases. Michigan versus Bryant is a case outside the domestic violence context, however. Instead, it harkens back to the evidentiary question of the admissibility of a dying declaration or an excited utterance. This case involved a man named Anthony Covington who eventually died from a gunshot wound. While Mr. Covington was bleeding to death and waiting for an ambulance, police approached him and he told police that Rick, apparently referring to the defendant, Richard Bryant, had shot him. The facts of this case occurred back in 2001. Mr. Covington was lying beside his car at a gas station with a gunshot wound to his stomach. The police asked him what had happened, who had shot him, and where the shooting had occurred. Mr. Covington said that around 3 a.m., about 30 minutes before the police found him, he had a conversation with Rick, whom he recognized based upon his voice, through the back door of Richard Bryant's house. When Mr. Covington turned to leave, he was shot through the door. He then drove to the gas station where police found him. Mr. Covington gave the address of Mr. Bryant's residence as the scene of the shooting. An ambulance transported Mr. Covington to the hospital where he died within a few hours. At Mr. Bryant's murder trial, the Detroit, Michigan State Trial Court admitted Mr. Covington's statements under the excited utterance exception to the rule against hearsay, and Mr. Bryant was convicted. Mr. Bryant appealed his conviction on the ground that the state's use of Mr. Covington's statements at trial violated his Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause right. The Michigan Court of Appeals upheld the conviction, but the Michigan Supreme Court reversed. The state then filed a petition for certiorari seeking review of the state court's decision, which was granted. In the Crawford case, of course, Justice Scalia wrote for the Supreme Court under the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment that witnesses who want to testify against a criminal defendant have to do so in court and subject themselves to cross-examination. 2 years later, in Davis v. Washington, the court held that a statement resulting from a police interrogation may be presented at trial, even if the witness is not available to testify. If its, quote, primary purpose, end quote, was to meet a, quote, ongoing emergency, end quote. The emergency in the Davis case was a domestic disturbance between the declarant and a former boyfriend recorded on a 911 call. In its most recent case involving the Confrontation Clause, Melendez-Diaz versus Massachusetts in 2009, the court was closely divided on the question of whether laboratory reports prepared by a state forensic analyst but without accompanying testimony violated the Confrontation Clause. The court ruled that such reports did violate the Confrontation Clause in a 5-4 vote. In Michigan versus Bryant, this case, the court faced the question whether a statement by a dying victim was made during an ongoing emergency and thus could be admitted without violating the defendant's rights under the Confrontation Clause. The arguments before the court from the prosecution were from the state of Michigan, which argued that the ongoing emergency, which was recognized in the Davis case, is not limited to the crime itself, but instead also extends to other emergencies resulting from the crime. To Michigan, Mr. Covington's gunshot wound to the abdomen created an ongoing medical emergency. Further, Michigan pointed to the armed gunman who could pose a further threat to officers and to others. Michigan argued that to assess the level of danger, the police needed to know whether the shooter was in Mr. Covington's vicinity and had he shot anyone else. The police questioning of the victim about the nature and location of the shooting was intended to seek that information. Whether a statement by a witness was made to meet an ongoing emergency to the state of Michigan depended on the circumstances under which the questioning happened rather than on the substance of the statement. So a statement is testimonial if it records a declarant's version of the events having already transpired versus what the state saw as Mr. Covington's spontaneous statement made during an emergency, which would not be testimonial. The defense arguments were that Mr. Bryant responded that an ongoing emergency requires a crime to be in progress. Because Mr. Covington told the police that the shooting occurred about 30 minutes ago and several blocks away, no emergency existed. To Mr. Bryant, the crime had concluded by the time the police found Mr. Covington at the gas station, as evidenced by the police not drawing their weapons or securing the gas station. To Mr. Bryant, Michigan's interpretation of an ongoing emergency was far too expansive. The state's definition could exclude from cross-examination any witness statements made in response to police questions when the perpetrator was still at large. Rather than focusing on the questions asked, Mr. Bryant argues that whether a statement is testimonial depends on what the witness said and why the witness said it. Because Mr. Covington merely narrated facts about past events without asking for help, for Mr. Bryant, the statements were testimonial and thus properly excluded. In a 6-2 decision, the Supreme Court in Michigan versus Bryant held that a statement given to police by a wounded crime victim identifying the person who shot him may be admitted as evidence at the trial if the victim dies before trial and thus does not appear. Because the primary purpose of the interrogation was to enable police to deal with an ongoing emergency, the court held that the statements resulting from the interrogation were not testimonial and therefore could be admitted into evidence without violating the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment. Justice Sotomayor wrote the majority opinion with separate dissents by Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg. Justice Kagan did not participate in the case. The court reasoned in three broad steps. In the first step, the court pointed out that the context of the statement is not a domestic dispute and the ongoing emergency extending beyond an initial victim to a potential threat to the responding police and the public. In this first step, the court considered its cases in Crawford and Davis, as well as in Hammond versus Indiana, a 2006 case, and it decided additional clarification was necessary of what the primary purpose of the interrogation is to enable police assistance to meet an ongoing emergency. In the second broad step, the court elaborated upon this primary purpose determination. Justice Sotomayor, for the court, stated that the court must objectively evaluate the circumstances in which the encounter between the individual and the police occurs, as well as the party's statements and actions. The primary purpose of the inquiry is objective. The existence of an ongoing emergency is among the circumstances informing the interrogation's primary purpose. And the statements and actions of both the declarant and the police questioners also provide objective evidence of the interrogation's primary purpose. In the third broad step, the court concluded that Mr. Covington's encounter with the police, including his statements and actions and those of the police, objectively indicated that the interrogation's primary purpose was to enable police assistance to meet an ongoing emergency. The facts the court relied upon included an armed shooter and the motive for and location after the shooting being unknown. The ability to distinguish the Davis and Hammond cases was also relied upon because the dispute did encompass both the police and the public. The court concluded that the primary purpose of the interrogation was not to establish or prove past events, but to enable the police to meet an ongoing emergency. Finally, the court analogized the facts before it to a harried 911 call, such as what occurred in the Davis case, rather than a structured station house interview, as occurred in Crawford. To the court, the informality which was found in the scene suggested that the primary purpose of the police was to address what they considered to be an ongoing emergency, and the circumstances lacked a formality that would have alerted Mr. Covington to or focused Mr. Covington on the possibility of future prosecutorial use of his statements. Accordingly, the court ruled that Mr. Covington's out-of-court statements were not testimonial and that their admission at Mr. Bryant's trial did not violate the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment. The Supreme Court left for Michigan's courts to decide on remand whether the statement's admissions were otherwise permitted by state hearsay rules, but the court did vacate the judgment of the Supreme Court of Michigan and remanded the case for further proceedings not inconsistent with the Supreme Court's opinion. Justice Thomas concurred in the judgment, agreeing with the court that the admission of Mr. Covington's out-of-court statements did not violate the Confrontation Clause, but Justice Thomas reached that conclusion for a slightly different reason. To Justice Thomas, Mr. Covington's questioning by police lacked sufficient formality and solemnity for Mr. Covington's statements to be considered testimonial. Rather than trying to reconstruct the primary purpose of the participants, Justice Thomas considered the extent to which the questioning resembled the historical practices that the Confrontation Clause had addressed. Because of the highly informal circumstances, officers arriving at different times, each officer upon arrival asking what happened, including asking duplicate questions, Justice Thomas concluded that the introduction of Mr. Covington's statements did not violate the Confrontation Clause. Dissent. In his own inimitable manner, Justice Scalia describes the conclusion the court reaches on these facts as patently incorrect and says that the decision leaves the court's Confrontation Clause jurisprudence in shambles. He even terms the court the obfuscator of last resort. In dissent, Justice Scalia takes a historical tour of the Confrontation Clause from its incorporation and being made binding on the states in 1965, in the case of Poynter versus Texas, to the fact that not all hearsay falls within the clause's grasp. In Crawford and Davis, the court did not address whose perspective matters, the declarant's, the interrogator's, or both, when assessing the primary purpose of an interrogation. In those cases, the statements were testimonial from any perspective. Justice Scalia thought the same was true here in Michigan versus Bryant, but because the court had chosen a perspective, so did Justice Scalia, that of the declarant. For Justice Scalia, a declarant-focused inquiry is the only inquiry that would work in every fact pattern implicating the Confrontation Clause. Justice Scalia took issue with the majority's adoption of a test that looked to the purpose of both the police and the declarant because such a test would give too much flexibility, such as trying to sort out the primary purpose of a declarant when that declarant had mixed motives. Instead, looking to the declarant's purpose, he found this to be an easy case. From Mr. Covington's perspective, his statements, what happened, when it happened, who shot him, where it took place, had little value other than to ensure the arrest and eventual prosecution of Mr. Bryant. He distinguished Davis because the 911 caller in that case was describing events as they were actually happening instead of 30 minutes ago. Further, Justice Scalia did not find the colloquy between Mr. Covington and the officers to be out of place at a jury trial. Even taking the perspective of the police, Justice Scalia found this to be an easy case, since the actions of none of the police demonstrated that they perceived an imminent threat. For Justice Scalia, the decision created an expansive exception to the Confrontation Clause for violent crimes. He found no Framers-era cases that took this view of the right to confrontation. Accordingly, he saw the court receding from Crawford in two ways. First, by reinserting reliability as the guide to Confrontation Clause jurisprudence, and second, requiring judges to do open-ended balancing tests into the totality of the circumstances bearing upon reliability. Justice Scalia ends his dissent with the following paragraph. Quote, "For all I know, Bryant has received his just deserts, but he surely has not received them pursuant to the procedures that our Constitution requires. And what has been taken away from him has been taken away from us all," end quote. In a second dissent, Justice Ginsburg agreed with Justice Scalia that Mr. Covington's statements were testimonial and that the declarant's intent is what counts. She wrote to add one observation. In Crawford, the court noted that in English common law, there was a well-established exception to the confrontation requirement. The cloak protecting the accused against admission of out-of-court testimonial statements was removed for dying declarations. That historic exception was noted by the court in Giles versus California, a 2008 case, which was applied to statements made by a person about to die and aware that death was imminent. Justice Ginsburg would take up the question of whether the dying declaration exception survives the court's recent Confrontation Clause decisions. However, the Michigan Supreme Court held as a matter of state law that the prosecutor in this case had abandoned that issue. So where is Confrontation Clause law after Michigan versus Bryant? The nub of the debate, of course, is whether questions asked by police at the crime scene are to assess risk as part of an ongoing emergency or to collect evidence. Some undoubtedly will see the decision in Michigan versus Bryant as a retreat from Crawford. This would explain the strong language of Justice Scalia's dissent, as he is known as a champion of the Confrontation Clause doctrine, and he has written most of the majority opinions concerning the clause over the last several years. In Justice Scalia's view, this was a straightforward case. The statements made by the victim should not be admitted into evidence because the police were investigating a crime when the victim said that Bryant had shot him. Because these statements were elicited during an investigation, for Justice Scalia, the police's intent in eliciting the statement was testimonial, intended for future use, including at a trial. The question emanating from this decision is what type of room it gives courts to characterize a statement as testimonial. Some will argue that it gives courts and the police broad room, while others will argue the decision is more moored to its facts. No doubt in this decision, the court has given a broad approach to determining what is testimonial. It takes the primary purpose language of the Davis case, and rather than a test to choose between whether a statement is testimonial or made in response to an ongoing emergency, the argument now centers on determining the primary purpose of the conversation in which the witness's statements were made. Determining primary purpose is a difficult task, as pointed out by Justice Thomas in his concurrence in Michigan v. Bryant and in his dissent in the Davis case. Two thoughts to ponder. First, will police officers learn to get statements characterized as non-testimonial if they testify that public safety was their concern and what the person said was important for that purpose? Second, the decision in Michigan v. Bryant, while establishing an objective test, did clarify by explicitly rejecting the notion of an absolute formality requirement, even though it does give formality considerable force. The decision preserves the possibility that statements made to persons other than governmental officials could be testimonial. Long-term Confrontation Clause observers will wonder whether this is a return to the pre-Crawford world of Ohio versus Roberts, which gave courts considerable latitude to allow the admissibility of many statements. How far that journey into the past may or may not go awaits the next fact pattern. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.